Hi there, this is the Romance Program. I'm volunteer Jeannie Yost for Sun Sounds. I've got one story coming up this hour. It's from True Love Magazine. It's called What Terror Awaits in the House on Manderley Lane. Here's the story. I was falling like Alice in Wonderland. It was a slow, agonizing descent, and when I looked up, I was filled with terror. Above me, the arched window with its tiny panels of stained glass around the edge was wide open. The darkening sky shone through the canopy of tall trees, and the gray head leaned through the window, watching as I fell to the ground. I heard myself scream loud and shrill. Someone was shaking me. I awoke in my own bed. My eyes were wet with tears as I struggled with the reality of the dream. My husband, Ian, lay beside me in the early dawn. His eyes regarded me with a look of disgust. "You were yelling again," he sighed, not understanding the residue of the nightmare still clinging to me. Angry that I'd interrupted his sleep. I'm sorry, I apologized. I shivered, cold from the layer of perspiration that coated my body and soaked my thin nightgown. You scared the daylights out of me. He sighed, that long sigh of his that came from his toes up through his body, the sound that managed to activate my guilt hormones every single time. I apologized again. I tried to put my arms around him. I was seeking solace more for myself than him. He moved away, feeling isolated and alone. I pulled on my threadbare Chanel robe, chilled to the bone. I got up and padded barefoot down the hall. From the dryer, I extracted a shirt and a pair of sweatpants. In the kitchen, I made myself a cup of herbal tea and cupped my freezing hands around the steaming mug. I hadn't had that dream in months. The dream began in childhood with the panic of falling, never hitting the ground. In my mind's eye, I could still see the old gray head high above me, leaning out the arched window, eyes alight, enjoying my terror. Ian suggested that I was punishing myself for something that had happened in my childhood. Maybe an old movie lived on in the corridors of my mind. I always awakened before I hit the ground. Was that significant? When I asked a doctor about my problem, he lectured me about childhood fears and insecurities. He said that a stable environment would make the nightmare disappear, and it had for a brief time after we married. But then it returned, and this time the terror hung around for days after the dream ended. For some reason, I couldn't rid myself of the residual fear left within me. I wondered if Ian's disappointment at not having a child was making me punish myself. When the nightmare returned with a vengeance, I rationalized that it was retribution for me not being able to produce the heir that Ian so desired. Oh, we'd been content in the beginning. Well, as content as we could be until we tried and tried to have the baby. Ian felt cheated, and he made that absolutely clear to me. Finally, we sought expert advice from one specialist and then another. Ian's sperm count was low, but my husband refused to look at alternatives. Ian blamed me. It was easier that way. As the doctors and the tests ate up our savings, Ian complained constantly about our finances. In one of our more heated arguments, he suggested that I go to work to keep myself occupied, but I knew that he really wanted to rebuild our tattered savings account. It was about this time that the community college offered real estate licensing as part of their night classes. To be truthful, it wasn't something that I'd ever considered before. However, the timing seemed right, so I enrolled. It kept me away in the evenings. Ian didn't mind. Studying was grueling. I'd been out of school for 7 years by then, and I was out of touch with textbooks. I became so busy with the house and pursuing my new vocation that I didn't even realize that as I was moving ahead, Ian was becoming increasingly distant. It was a great day when I passed my exam and received my real estate license. Ian smiled a tight little smile and said all the right things. In the excitement of the moment, I didn't notice the change coming over him. He had always been surly and used to getting his own way. The only difference now was that I'd become too busy to let it overwhelm me. Whether he liked it or not, my new job had been his idea. The fact that I wasn't home anymore to cater to his every whim was his own fault, the way I looked at it. Honestly, I was amazed. It was the first time in our marriage that I'd ever put myself first. I went to work full time. I loved my job. 2 years passed and we settled in as an old married couple. We were both too busy to notice or maybe even to care about the deterioration of our relationship. The arguments stopped. We lived in a shared silence, frequently ignoring each other altogether. Ian didn't ignore my commissions, however. With the extra money, we vacationed one Christmas in Hawaii. The following Easter found us on a cruise to the Bahamas. We were the envy of all our friends, or rather associates. We didn't have many friends. Time passed quickly. We spent what our associates thought were idyllic weekends together. We took exotic vacations, always together, yet painfully, achingly alone. We bought a lovely cottage on the lake. We flew for mere weekends at the beach. The last time we were there, it rained the whole time, but we never mentioned it to our associates, who were all jealous and envious of us. Ian played it to the hilt. They never suspected that underneath all the hype, our relationship was anything less than what we exhibited to the public. Oh, those great vacations, Ian remained remote. He always had his nose stuck in a book. Later, I came to realize that when he was reading, he didn't have to deal with me. So I started reading too. Time moved its great celestial hands over the ticking clock. Days wandered into weeks and weeks into years. We had become workaholics. If you had asked, we would have insisted that we had an ideal existence. But if you'd peeked in our window, you would have discovered that we barely tolerated each other. In our way, we were both successful. We each had a nice car. Our house was tastefully furnished and never dirty. A slight bit dusty, perhaps, but never dirty. There were no children to wreak havoc in our two-bedroom cottage with a white picket fence and flowers. The American dream. Ha! Huh. I longed for a large two-story house on the edge of town. I wanted a big dining room. In my fantasies, I could see the room with its tall ceilings and an ornate mirror on the wall. We needed an attic where a child could play on rainy days, but Ian pointed out that we were rarely at home except to sleep. We could live in an apartment and be just as happy, he stated. Happy? I stared at him. Was this happy? Now, as I look back, I realize that we were play-acting for the people around us. They thought we were living an ideal life, carefree and footloose. They never saw the strained relationship that truly existed. We'd become great actors. It was the last week of March when we had a dandy apart argument. Up to that time, most of our disagreements had been animated discussions. That time, however, we surpassed the discussion stage. Ian had been complaining all day. Nothing seemed to be right. He detested his job. The meal was hurried. I knew that he was tired, and I tried to overlook his surliness. On the telephone, we were cordial, even loving, because people were around. Face to face was a whole different story. When he told me I had to drive him to the airport at 5 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, I blew sky high. I didn't care that he needed to be in Colorado for an early Monday morning meeting. I didn't want to hear it. I was in the middle of the monthly ironing, and I was tired from painting the front porch. I accused him of not helping me. He yelled, "If the job is too much, then quit." I yelled back, "You're the one who insisted I go to work." Frustrated, I started crying. He stormed from the house. "I'll leave my car at the airport," he stated as the door banged shut behind him. "Don't expect me to be here when you come back," I yelled, like I had any place to go. We had had arguments before, but this was the most terrifying. It left me with a king-sized headache and enormous feelings of guilt. When I regained control, I drove frantically to the airport. We had 5 minutes together before he left. I fell into his arms, apologizing and sobbing. People stared at us. I didn't care. He said he was sorry for all the things he'd said. What good was the money if we didn't have time to spend it? We were both teary-eyed as he kissed me and walked reluctantly down the ramp. As I watched him disappear, I felt desolate. We had so little time together, and I had spent it unwisely. We were both tired. We'd been running away, not only from each other, but also from ourselves. Monday, I went to the office, moving through my duties like a robot. My enthusiasm had fled. I guess I was in another one of those depressions where life had little meaning. My mouth was dry, and the band of pain encircling my head became a dull headache. The night I had the recurring night, or that night I had the recurring nightmare of falling from that window, never hitting the ground, just feeling the horror as I flew through the air. I forced myself to get up, dress, and go to work. All day long I dragged myself around. I was withdrawn and I'd lost my appetite. I was irritable and my colleagues were giving me a wide berth. When Ian arrived home from his trip, my gloom lifted. We had a great night. Our lovemaking was tender. After I lay in his arms, remembering our early days, our honeymoon, maybe, just maybe, we could work things out. We made plans for Friday. I quit early and had my hair done. Then Ian was late coming home. He'd forgotten our dinner plans and neglected to call. I was waiting for him. We had a shouting match. I blamed him. He blamed me. I had had the nightmare the night before and had gotten very little sleep. I broke down and wept. He put his arms around me. It was a warm feeling. We ended up in bed. It was passionate and rough. We needed physical release. Then, to my delight, we talked all night long. We decided that we wanted to save our floundering marriage and to do that we needed to spend more time with each other. Foolishly, we focused on the company road trips as the reason for our unhappiness. To my surprise, Ian discussed our situation with his boss, and he was offered a position with a satellite company in central New York. It would mean less money, but no travel. Impulsively, we sold our house and the cottage at the lake. We packed, and without looking back, moved north. It seemed so easy and right. We thought a new location would bring us the elusive happiness. We rented a two-bedroom apartment on Spring Street and shared our furniture. Ian started working immediately. His new position was challenging, and he liked his new staff. As he settled in, my depression returned. I thought the move and the new life was what I'd needed, but something was wrong with me. Ian didn't know about the dark shroud that seemed to cover me. I tried to hide my inner feelings. I made an attempt to be enthusiastic about our plans for the future. We were still together, after all, but he'd taken a cut in pay to make me happy, so I couldn't let him see my pain. No, we'd thought the relocation would help, but we'd only brought the problem with us. What kind of a person was I? My husband had given up a lucrative position to have more time with me, and I was still miserable, but I made up my mind that he would never know. Too late, I realized that his job had not been the basis for my depression. I seriously thought about seeking out a therapist, but I didn't want Ian to know that I was sinking deeper and deeper into mental illness. It was about this time that the nightmare became more vivid. I started not sleeping so I wouldn't have the dream. I'd lie beside Ian until he dozed off. Then he'd slip out of bed and sit on the sofa until the light filtered in through the blinds. Exhausted, I'd snooze off and on during the day. My hormones were screwed up, and so was I. The crazy sleep pattern was in my face. I looked 10 years older. My complexion was sallow, and my hair hung limp. I looked like a raccoon with two black eyes. Nothing seemed worthwhile. I needed professional help. But when I discovered that the visits were over $100 an hour, I gave up on that idea. I could never pay that high a fee, and I felt I'd hurt Ian enough. I couldn't give him a child, and now I couldn't give him happiness. So I was a miserable person. But I glued a smile on my face. Ian was too busy to notice that anything was wrong. He couldn't possibly notice how upset and disconnected I was all of the time. It really wouldn't matter to him anyway. Monday morning came dark and misty. Snow covered the ground with a dull gray color. Outside, the weather was damp and dreary. Inside, so was I. I had wanted this move, but sometimes getting what you want just isn't the right thing. Wanting what you're getting makes more sense, but I wasn't rational. I literally dragged myself off of the sofa. I made myself shower and dress. Our small apartment was more of a storage area than a home. Unpacked cardboard boxes huddled behind the furniture like sardines in a can. I puttered around, but it was useless. I was making busy work. I had a headache the size of New York City. I swallowed 2 aspirins. Bored, I drove around the town of about 10,000. I located a small mall. It would have fit 7 times into the mall complex back home. I walked through the slush to the glass door and shoved it open. "We shouldn't have moved," I said aloud. Oh boy, I was talking to myself. I looked around to see if anyone had heard me. Depression clung to me like a shroud. In the center of the mall was a booth filled with crystals and tapes. I stopped to look at a wicker basket filled with tiny stones. I picked up a tape with a waterfall on it. "That's a relaxation tape," the lady behind the counter explained. I looked up. She had light brown hair and a smile that was infectious. In spite of my feeling of gloom, I returned her smile. "For your first tape, I would suggest the rainforest. It has soothing sounds." "My first tape? How would she know?" "No thanks," I said, dropping the tape back into the box. "Having a bad day?" she stated, rather than asked. She wasn't going to let me go. "No, I'm not having a bad day," I retorted, turning away. I felt she was getting personal, but something drew me back. I picked up a long crystal, lavender and smooth. As she waited on another customer, I held the crystal. It felt warm and alive in my hand. "Find something you like?" she asked, returning to give me her full attention. I don't know anything about stuff like this," I admitted, dropping the crystal back into the wicker basket. "Crystals enhance your spirit. Some help with spiritual healing. Others may increase the vibrations in your energy field. Crystals serve many purposes. Amethyst is for calming." I'm not interested," I said, backing away. "I'll be here all weekend," she offered. "You're an old soul, you know. You've lived before." Her words made the hair on the back of my neck stand right up. "Depressed?" she asked. But her tone made it more of a declarative statement than a question. She frightened me. "You need to go back to work." I felt invaded. I turned away to beat a rapid retreat. "The periods of depression you're experiencing stem from the pains of another lifetime," she called to me as I strode away. I was choking as I hurried outside and gasped for air. My heart was pounding in my ears. I was shaking. The woman's words echoed in the corridors of my mind. In my car, I waited until my heart rate slowed. My hands groped the steering wheel. I sat taking great gulps of air in through my mouth. I needed help, and soon, I realized as I drove away. I braked for a stop sign. Ian would be furious if he knew I'd even talked to a psychic. Across the street, a big red and white sign caught my attention. Stearns Realty. My car seemed to drive itself into the parking lot. Suddenly, I had an urgent need to talk to someone, anyone. Apprehensively, I went in. My legs were weak from my encounter with the crystal lady. I tried to shake off the eerie feeling that she'd created inside of me with a few choice words. "I'm looking for a house in the 60 to 80,000 bracket," I told the woman at the front desk. She looked up from her paperwork and smiled. She was tall and thin, with salt and pepper hair pulled back in a barrette at the nape of her neck. She wore a black suit with a cream-colored blouse. Gold bracelets rattled up and down her arm. Her eyes were red-trimmed. She'd clearly been crying. Sit down, she smiled. She pulled a chair from the corner and moved it to the side of her desk. Here's our directory. Take a look if you see anything you might like. I'll be right here to help. I'm Sandra Stern. I own the agency. Her eyes were lavender like the crystal. She dabbed at them with a tissue and blew her nose. Obviously, she was having a bad day, too. I bent to the book as she went into the back office. I could hear her talking on the telephone. I didn't pay any attention as I stared down at the listing sheets before me and really seeing them. What did the crystal lady take me for? A nut? Well, she sure knew a nut when she saw one. Then, suddenly, the room seemed to sway before me, and a patch of indigo hung in front of my eyes for a brief second, startling me. Are you all right? Ms. Stern asked. You're white as a sheet. She put her hand on my shoulder. Are you all right? She repeated, louder this time, her hand tightening on my arm. I could see concern in her eyes and could smell Lily of the Valley perfume as she leaned over me. I don't know, I answered. Honestly, I had a spell, I think. I tried a laugh, but it went flat. Sandra Stern stared down at me. Her bright eyes looked locked with mine. I met a psychic at the mall, and what she told me shook me up, I guess, I confessed. I feel so inadequate suddenly. I sniffled. Sandra bent over the desk and handed me a box of tissues. How about a cup of tea? She led me into a tiny kitchenette at the rear of the office. For a brief moment, I thought about running away. I was making a total fool out of myself, blabbing to a total stranger. But I sat on a stool beside a small counter while she filled two cups with water, added tea bags, and slid them into a microwave. I just had my fortune told in the mall. Reluctantly, I grinned. The woman said some pretty strange things to me. Scared you, huh? She laughed as she set a steaming cup in front of me. I guess I wasn't ready for her, I admitted, and added cream to my tea. She suggested that I go back to work and quit feeling sorry for myself. I added a teaspoon of sugar and stirred forcefully. That's good advice for anyone, she chuckled, kind of generic. We just moved into town. I don't know anyone. Where can I find a job? I shrugged. Sounds like you're making excuses for yourself. Are you going to take her advice? Are you hiring? Do you have a license? Not for New York, I shrugged. Well, you'll need a couple of classes, she said thoughtfully. Maybe the psychic knew what she was talking about. She pulled a brochure from the bulletin board to the right of the counter. Surprisingly enough, there just happens to be a real estate course starting next week at the community college. You'll need to bone up on state law, of course, and then you can take the test. She sipped her tea. If, when you pass, I can use you. Suddenly, a big tear ran down her cheek. One of our agents, Don Turner, had a heart attack 2 weeks ago and he won't be returning. She leaned her elbow on the counter and put her chin in her hand. He was my best friend, but it looks like open heart surgery if we can get him through the next 2 weeks. That's a shame, I said as I sat back to think. We sat in silence, sipping our tea. I have so much to do, I lied, thinking of our tiny apartment. I need to find a house and get settled. My husband's very busy with his new job. Are you going to challenge destiny?" she asked, her lavender eyes twinkling. "Destiny? Didn't your psychic tell you to go to work?" "Well," she grinned, "maybe the fates drew you to this office. I need help and you need a job. Do you believe in coincidences?" I don't believe in that," I stated. She shrugged. "I signed up for the classes. Ian was pleased. I'd been kidding myself, thinking that he didn't know about my depression. The apartment's filled with our belongings. There's nothing to clean," he laughed. "Not a flat surface that isn't cluttered. And after you get your license, I'll be your first customer. This time, I want a big house." "With a yard and a dog," I said. "I'd also like a stained glass window." He laughed, playing along with me, "and a full basement and a garage. New York winters make garages a necessity." "I want flowers," I added to the list, careful not to mention a child. We spent the whole rest of that evening discussing our criteria for the house that I'd find for us. The Crystal Lady had started a chain of events. Life was rushing at us like a runaway locomotive, and we were too stupid to get off the track. I tried not to put too much thought into her message, but I stayed out of the mall for a long time afterward. After my license came, I became very active at the office. I learned the town and soon knew every street and alleyway. My sales were good. I met the other agent, Sarah Chambers, a redhead who was full of energy and good ideas. We were instant friends. Don Turner, recovering from surgery, occasionally wandered through the office, hooked up to his oxygen tank. Everyone but Don admitted that he wouldn't be returning. It was an August morning that started out normally, but erupted into something truly bizarre. It all began with Sandra listing the house on Manderley Lane. "It's not like any old two-story farmhouses," she said, laying the information sheets atop my desk. "In fact, it was a masterpiece of construction around the turn of the century. It needs work, though, so we can advertise it as a handyman's special." "Rustic, huh?" Sarah laughed. "Back in the 1900s, it was a fully functional working farm. The Marlowe family lived there. It's rumored he was a tyrant, so we'll probably be plagued by ghosts." Sandra shook her head and rolled her eyes at me. As you can see, Sarah has a very active imagination. The wiring's old. The plumbing's old," Sarah read from the listing sheet. "The ghost is old," I giggled, but goosebumps rode up my arms, and for an instant I was chilled. Sandra tried to ignore us. "We can definitely sell the secluded location. There are 100-year-old oak trees all over the property, surrounding it like they're almost guarding the house." "Guarding the house?" Sarah raised her eyebrows and whispered. "From what?" "Finister Creedmoor is the caretaker," Sandra added. Now there's a treat." Sarah rolled her eyes. "He's the town character," she told me, laughing, "and as old as the house. It's an estate. The family lives in Arizona," Sandra continued, ignoring her. "So we need to conduct our dealings through the family attorney, Reuben Smith. Chester Marlowe is said to have been a miserable man. His daughter had a baby out of wedlock." Sarah sighed. "Back in those days, an unwed mother was bad news," Sandra admitted. Rumor is, Sarah began, relishing the gossip, that he let her come home and treated her like a servant. She died mysteriously and left him in charge of the child. Do you think the house is haunted? By whom? I asked. The kid of the old geezer? Don't forget to factor in the kid's mother, Sarah added. She's the one he murdered. Murdered? I screeched. Stop it, you two. Ghost or no ghost, I need to show the place tonight, Sandra said to me. I have to pick up a client at the airport at 6. Sarah's tied up, so you'll have to cover the exec from Schooner Industries. He's new in town, and I haven't been able to reach him by telephone to postpone. Can you meet him? Sure. But if there's a ghost, does the price increase or decrease? I asked. Sandra arched her left eyebrow and refused to play into the fantasy. So there I was at 6 o'clock, parked in the rutted driveway, looking at the old house on Manderley Lane. The sun was getting ready to say goodnight to the valley. My window was rolled down, and I listened to the sounds of the peepers in the surrounding woods. The house rose 3 stories. The paint was peeling. Clearly, it had once been a glorious sight. The trim was full of curls and scrolls. Stained glass outlined the attic windows at the top. The lawn had been cut, and a few of the bushes were nearly trimmed. I could smell the newly mown grass, and off in the distance, crickets chirped. I felt nervous for some reason. I stepped from the car and fumbled in my bag for the key. I pocketed the car keys in my left pocket and the house key in my right. Then, as usual, I tossed my purse into the trunk. I had my information sheet on the clipboard as I approached the house. I glanced up at the attic windows. I saw a flickering light there. Oh my God, a fire! I cried to no one. I dropped my clipboard and ran up the 4 steps into the wide veranda that wrapped itself around the house. I fumbled in my pocket for the key and inserted it into the lock. Frantically, I shoved the door back and ran into the foyer. I sprang up the stairs and down the hall to a bedroom at the rear of the house. Playmates, come out and play with me, I heard a child's voice singing. The little voice didn't really register on the blackboard of my mind as I was so singularly focused upon the prospect of a fire. I dashed into the back bedroom and unlocked the attic door with the old-fashioned skeleton key hidden atop the door casing. I opened the door and plunged through. I rushed up the narrow 13 steps and plunged into the dark recesses of the room at the top. The sun was dipping and the last vestiges of light were shifting different colors through the small arched window. Nothing. No fire. No light. Sarah's ghostly comments had caused me to see trouble where no trouble existed. Your imagination is working overtime, dear, I giggled nervously. I opened the small cathedral-style window outlined with tiny squares of stained glass and leaned out. I could see my car parked down below in the driveway as I peered out. Suddenly, it was as if my dream had come to life. The ground came rushing up to meet me. I felt a fear too great to be explained. Shaking, I slid down and plunked myself down onto the dirty floor. My navy blue suit was instantly coated with a fine dusty gray soot. My pantyhose snagged on a ragged floorboard as my high heels slid off my feet. My ears were filled with the noise of rushing blood. I felt dizzy as I sat there, waiting for my heart to slow down. I tried to swallow past the fear in my throat, and when the room had stopped spinning, I made myself look out the window again. The fear was still there that time, but not the intensity. You fool, you reminded yourself of the nightmare. That's why it happened. It's daylight, for God's sake. Well, twilight anyway. I closed the window and leaned against the rough-hewn wallboards. My heart continued to race and the dizziness lingered. The bare floorboards caught at my nylons and I shoved my feet back into my pumps just as a long, jagged run appeared in my new hose. I brushed the dust from my skirt and picked off a cobweb. I put one foot in front of the other, willing myself to look into the dark corners. Where was the flickering flame? The rational part of me wanted to get out of that attic as quickly as I could. The curious part held me there. I realized that my palms were sweating. The dingy third floor gave me a feeling of absolute dread. So I tried to rationalize my adventure. I figured I must have seen the sunset reflected in the window. I walked to the corner and pulled the chain on a small bare 60-watt light bulb. It did little to dispel the gloom. The dust and filth of 50 years surrounded me. I shivered again and goosebumps raised on the back of my neck. The attic was furnished with a small iron bed. I reached over and touched it, and my hand drew back, covered with a fine gray dust. It was then that I noticed something written in the dust atop the iron rung. Clara. The four letters were scratched in a desperate need to be known. The mattress was disconcerting. Straw protruded from it, and I could see that a mouse or two had waited out the winter here. I wandered through the attic, repulsed yet curious. It was then that I remembered the tiny voice and song. The child had to be outside, and yet she'd sounded so close by as I climbed the stairs. I found a round switch and turned it. Another tiny bulb sprung to life, but did little to dispel the growing darkness. Under the eaves in a small closet, I found a long tin box. I opened it and found a much-loved rag doll that had weathered the years. Annie, I thought as I hugged it to me. I felt an overwhelming sense of sadness. Get real, I said aloud. I turned to leave, still clutching the doll. There was my first ghost lurking at the top of the stairs, just outside the small circle of light. I dropped the doll and stood rooted to the spot. Chills made their way up my arms. My heart did flip-flops as the figure moved toward me. I felt faint as I reached out, and a jagged piece of board bit into my hand. The pain steadied me. I'm Date Westcott, the figure said, holding out his hand. His name was Dale. Oh, was all I could manage from my constricted throat, a shock. I shook myself. I thought you were a ghost. A ghost? His big eyes crinkled with humor. Well, I said, this is an attic. We both laughed. Are you sure you're not a ghost? A ghost in a suit and tie? Highly unlikely. His bright eyes twinkled. Don't ghosts wear sheets? I gave him my hand, my icy fingers warmed in his firm handshake. Suddenly, I felt safe. Without another word, he made a quick circle of the place, looking into the darkening recesses. Next time, I'll need a flashlight. Next time. That sounded good. I thought I might have blown the sail by mentioning a ghost. I had a flashlight out in my car, but the shadows were deepening and I was feeling uncomfortable. I wanted to get out of that house. I flicked the lights off and felt my way down the stairs. We did a quick tour of the four bedrooms. How did you find me in the attic? I asked as we started down the front staircase. I heard you singing. He smiled. But I'd been about to say that I hadn't been singing. Then I remembered the child's voice, another chill, and I hugged myself for warmth. Good realtor that I am, I immediately changed the direction of the conversation. The house had glory in the old days, I said as he followed me into the rustic kitchen. Here again, the bare light bulb dimly lit the room. Lathe showed from behind peeling wallpaper. On the floor, the linoleum was worn through to the boards. The porcelain sink was chipped and stained. It will take a lot to make it glorious again, he grinned. Then he laughed as he turned on the cold water faucet and heard it chug air. The water was turned off so the pipes wouldn't freeze, I explained. The house has been empty for quite a while. You have well water, but only water, but city water is available 500 feet up the road, so that's an option for you. Where's the electrical box? Out here, I told him. I opened the kitchen door onto the rear porch. There it is. He opened the antique electrical box and peered inside. What's that you're humming? He asked. I don't know, I answered, honestly. I heard the song as I entered the house. At first I thought a child was in here, but she must have been outside, I added as he stared at me in the gathering dusk. The bushes are encroaching upon the porch. It would be a great hideaway for a little girl. I tried to sound rational, but his gaze made me uncomfortable. He didn't say a word, but a slow grin went over his face as he followed me through the kitchen and along the hallway. I wondered what he was thinking, but for some reason, I didn't want to go there. Have you shown the house many times? He asked. This is my first time here, actually. Our broker just got the listing, so you have the distinction of being the first customer to see this magnificent formal dining room, I said as I threw my arms wide. He removed an immaculate white handkerchief from his pocket and wiped a large circle of grime from the enormous ornate mirror decorating the west wall. The French doors to the living room are beveled. What a great house, I exclaimed. He smiled at my enthusiasm. Are you thinking of purchasing it yourself? Oh, I hadn't thought about it, but I want a big house, a dog and flowers, and a kid. Do you have children? Not yet, I replied as pain knifed through my chest and old hurts surfaced. Suddenly, a shadow moved across the mirror. I whirled around. Nothing was behind me. I returned to the mirror. The shadow was still there. I blinked, and it was gone. Briefly, I thought about the light in the attic. I was a bit angry with myself for having let Sarah's ghost stories almost ruin a sail for me. Then, as I turned toward home, I put aside the cares of the day. Dinner and household chores awaited me. Ian was late and tired that night, complaining about problems at work. I wish we'd never moved, he finally exploded, jumping up from the table. I thought you loved the job. I was startled. It's none of your business. He thundered into the bedroom and slammed the door. We had only brought the problem with us when we moved. We were the problem. Naturally, I felt guilty. My job was going well, and I was enjoying the tiring but nevertheless challenging work. Ian, I'm sorry, I called through the locked door, not sure what I was sorry about. He ignored me. The next day, he dropped a bombshell. He wanted to take our savings and tour the country in a motor home. One of his clients had offered him a job as a ski instructor at a lodge in Aspen. Ski instructor? I didn't know you could ski, Ian. There's a lot you don't know about me. So was I going with him or not? For Ian, it was just that simple. Saturday evening found me waiting for Dale Westcott at the house on Manderley Lane. A lot of the brush had been cleared away. Someone had hung an old wooden swing on the veranda. Mr. Creedmore, I called as I stepped out of my car. You one of them realtors? I guess so. I have a man interested in purchasing the property. Wouldn't live here for any amount of money. Now, don't try to frighten me, I said aloud. Missy, I don't frighten nobody. I just know what I hear. I know what I see. I ain't about to be here after dark. That's not very nice, trying to scare a person. I tried to laugh. Sorry about that, Missy, but I heard tell that at the turn of the century, old man Marlowe was a mean man, and when he died, neither heaven nor hell wanted him. Sometimes at night you can see lights moving in the attic window. We both looked up at the window. Marlowe left no immediate family. He brought a young wife and child here. They were going to live here too, but they were scared off by the nighttime shenanigans, so they let the place rot. Where did you pick up all this gossip? Marlowe's a legend around here. He grinned. His teeth were yellow. Well, it's good they could find a man they could trust, I said. Ain't much left to worry about. I merely smiled. I didn't want him to know that he was making me apprehensive. Yes, yes, sirree, he was a mean man. I tried to shake his words. Remember what gossip did to your last time, I told myself. I went and sat on the old wooden swing at the far end of the veranda. Back and forth, the movement of the swing quieted me. I didn't hear him park his car or even come onto the porch. It's lovely here, was his only comment. I looked up, startled to see Duke Westcott. Caught you sleeping, he grinned. Without a word, I unlocked the front door. To hell with you and your freaky tales. I sent the thought to the absent Mr. Creedmore as I picked up the forgotten rag doll. Dale watched me in silence. Back downstairs, I avoided looking into the dining room mirror. Sarah and her ghosts, Creedmore and his legends. As we left, I turned the key in the lock and pocketed it. I sat down and Dale sat beside me. I'll make an offer based on the cost of city water and restoration. Anyway, it seems like such a sad house. You felt it too? I asked. He nodded. It has a personality all its own. I certainly like the location, though. I heard him say we and almost asked about it. It was getting dark. We could hear the crickets. Last time we were here, you mentioned that you'd never been here before. I hadn't, I admitted. It was my first time, and yet You popped the hidden compartments and ran through the house as if you knew it well. I was stunned by his observation. We have many homes for sale. Perhaps we have another one with the same floor plan. I could feel him looking at me. Was he accessing this bipolar person who could find hidden panels in a house she'd never set foot in before? I can't see a thing, he said. In the shaft of light, I looked at him. He had a square jaw with a dimple in the chin. How do you shave that? I asked, reaching out to touch the dimple. He chuckled. Then suddenly his arms were around me, warm and comforting. I felt him make love to me on the crumbling old porch. I felt wanton as I accepted him with abandon. Later, when I looked back on that delightful hour, it was as if we were suspended somewhere in time. Playmates, come out and play with me, the tiny voice wafted on the night air. I moved from the shelter of his arms. A week passed before I heard from Dale again. I'm sorry about last week. It won't happen again. I don't understand what came over me. Normally, I'm very shy. Shy? I laughed. He bought the house on Manderley Lane. When our schedules permitted, we'd meet late afternoons after the carpenters had left and make love in the master bedroom. And then my double life came to an end. That final Saturday, I was helping Dale wallpaper the dining room when he put his arms around me. I felt his warm breath on my neck. I watched us enjoying each other. Then, to my surprise, an old man joined us in the mirror. Suddenly, in the mirror, the old man's voice merged with Dale's. Goosebumps rose on my arms and neck. Dale thought the goosebumps and shivering was passion that he'd aroused in me. Later, as he slept, I gathered my belongings and left him a goodbye note. Ian was unhappy with his job. Dale called. I told him that it was over between us. I told him that I owed Ian another chance. Ian and I finally settled in Aspen. We laughed. He hadn't skied in years. Aspen turned out to be the perfect place to raise a daughter. And I know that Ian will be a great father. He'll never know that she is Dale's daughter. She will be our daughter, Ian's and mine. I will name her Clara, and this time I won't fail her. Okay, that's it for this romance show. Thanks so much for listening. This has been Volunteer Genios for Sun Sounds. Take care.